as I wait, heart of God.
Hello, Mike, and welcome to the Growth Group podcast, where we believe that spiritual growth happens better in circles than a dozen rows. My name is David Haken, and I'm joined by Jonathan Markham, the pastor of New Life Christian Fellowship here in Pacifica, California, and we record these podcasts to help you get the most out of your small group discussion each week. We are continuing our series on Deuteronomy this week. We've been in Deuteronomy for quite a while now, pretty much 2 months.
Yeah, we have.
I think there's been a good response from the congregation from this, I don't want to say odd book, but certainly a book that's collected dust on other people's shelves, I think.
It's certainly not the sort of book that if you ask the congregation to choose a book that we should study next. Yeah. Not many of them would say Deuteronomy.
Or even the pages of their Bible where they turn most. It might be something like Psalms, or maybe one of the Gospels. Or maybe
Deuteronomy is pretty much not going to...
Philippians, probably.
Yeah. Deuteronomy is not going to figure in that list very highly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we have discovered that it is powerfully relevant in many ways, and you know, I think that last week your sermon in and the buckets that you talked to us about, I think are really, really helpful. They're really helpful, particularly as we're sort of in the your sermon in the next sort of couple,
right?
Really, in a sense, in the deep weeds of the law.
Right. I mean, it's tough to do when you have such a big book like Deuteronomy. You have to cover at least a couple chapters each Sunday.
And, it's so easy to get lost in Deuteronomy.
Especially in the laws.
Yes, in the laws, because of the different ways in which the stuff in there, which is, as you so eloquently put it last week, weird.
There's something eloquent about the word weird.
Yes.
But there is a certain sense of, at least a loose organization, it appears, within the laws, doesn't it?
Right.
I mean, this little batch that I guess we heard this last Sunday, you preached on, is definitely a collection of laws regarding leadership.
And, you know, some of the commentators point out that, you know, they didn't, that the writers didn't have the same concept of needing to go through logical formats.
Yeah,
that
it's not
we
a legal
do.
Code like we would.
And they wrote, I mean, there are connections, but the connections are not necessarily the ones we would anticipate.
Right. Nothing's in chronological order.
No, nothing's in chronological order. Nothing is in sort of Western logical order. It's, you know, there's suddenly something comes up. And interestingly enough, you know, when the lot of the chapters, I know that you only loosely looked at them last week. A lot of them have sort of worship formats.
Right.
And
that's one of my regrets on my sermon. I didn't really get to talk about Deuteronomy 12, which I think is a super important chapter.
Yeah, it's a great chapter.
It's okay.
But now, but we're moving into, in a sense, this week, the people who made the worship possible, or the laws regarding the people who make the structure of the community possible.
Yeah. Well, we have a very clear structure on our growth group questions this week. We're going to look first at judges, then kings, prophets, and finally we're going to look at war, which is a super interesting chapter, chapter 20. Mm. But let's start with judges, which are kind of scattered really throughout a few different chapters, but this question in particular deals mostly with the end of chapter 16. Here's the question. Why are lawyer jokes a thing? I don't think they were in ancient Israel. Why do we denigrate what should be an honorable and noble calling? It could be the difference in qualifications for office. Lawyers today have to pass the bar. What qualifications were expected of Israelite judges? Think of a few other contemporary professions, teacher, engineer, police officer, etc., and craft a Deuteronomy-like set of qualifications for each. So, qualifications for judges, there in Deuteronomy 16.
Right. And in a sense, there, interestingly enough, it doesn't say anywhere they should have a good knowledge of the law.
I am so glad you mentioned that. I had studied for, you know, many hours in preparation for my sermon on the law, and I was listening to the Bible Project podcast. You guys should check it out. I mean, it's probably not as good as our podcast, but it's a pretty good podcast.
Yeah, I've been listening to it too.
Yeah, wonderful. And you probably listened to the episodes on the law, where they were talking about a statutory law society, which is like our society, in which all the laws are written down explicitly by the letter, and then a customary or a common law society, in which the laws that are written, and there are written laws like we have in Deuteronomy, are merely examples. They're exemplatory laws where any given law isn't going to cover all possible situations,
right,
like our law today requires, so we can get around laws, you know, which is such a pain. But in these societies, it's just an example that sets forth kind of a moral principle by which judges have to use their own wise, virtuous discernment to evaluate in different
cases. And in this thing, you also look and you see that there are two types of law. Well, there are lots of different types, but there is permissive law and there is required law. And a lot of what we're looking here, this isn't permissive, this is requirement. But a lot of the other things that we're going to look at this week is permissive, in as much as it's not, it doesn't have to happen, but if it does happen, this is the way it should happen.
Okay, yeah. Like apodictic or causic or... Anyway, some other strange words to describe similar...
for instance, you know, we're going to get to
case law.
A king. They're not required to have a king, but if they do, this gives them permission and it gives them the laws.
It's interesting, when we look at the story of Samuel, and Samuel's like, hold up, if they ask for a king, that means they're rejecting you as king, God.
Right.
Isn't that a bad thing?
But it's very clear that God knew they were going to do that.
Yeah. Well, anyways, maybe we should use this as an opportunity to move to our second question, which is about kings. How about that?
We didn't really talk about the requirements.
Oh, please do. Okay.
I think that the interesting thing about the requirements for judges, they are behavioral and character. They're character commitments.
They don't have to pass the bar test.
They don't have to pass the bar
test.
But they do.
Kings do.
They are required to have a certain character.
Yeah.
And I would be so bold as to say, I think that's missing from our culture. The character requirements of people. You listen to football coaches talking about the guys they're going to draft. And sometimes they say, well, actually, their character is more important than their skills.
Yeah.
And I think that really looking at the requirement, and it's not just for lawyers, but for anyone to realize the primary importance of someone's character is...
And there's New Testament parallels, of course, when
right.
Paul is talking about qualifications for elders and for deacons. He talks primarily and almost exclusively about one's character and their relationship with their own family, although he does mention this phrase, able to teach, which has a doctrinal element
right.
to it. But it's largely character.
But it doesn't say you have to know every jot and tittle of the
If anything, in this same letter, he says don't focus overly on debatable matters. Shall we move on to this?
Yes, let's move. Yes.
Kings. As with other offices, Moses' intention in addressing kings here is not to give a full description of a king's responsibilities. Instead, he focuses on matters of temptation. What temptations will the kings face, and what antidote does Moses offer for these temptations? How did Israel's greatest king, Solomon, respond to these temptations? And what happened as a result? How does this story illuminate humanity's need for a king who is just and humanity's responsibility to heed the words of Paul in 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2?
Well, I might question the classification of Solomon as
greatest king?
As Israel's greatest king.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways of defining greatness as far as territorial expansion, wealth.
Certainly Solomon was king in their golden days.
Yeah.
But I think I'd probably go for David as their greatest king, but that's...
It flowed better with the question, so I sacrificed truth for artistic flourishes.
I'm glad to hear you do that on occasions, David, too. It's really interesting because basically most of the temptations are to do with having stuff like horses, really, all of those things are indicators of the ability to exercise power. Because the number of horses you had was an indication of your warfare prowess. Because a lot of wars that in those days were fought by infantry, but once you got horses and chariots, then you had great difficulty. And he's saying,
right,
you know,
it was the tanks of the ancient world,
right? And you've got, and if we remember consistently, God is saying to these people, look, the way you're going to win wars is not by your warfare; it's by I deal with that.
Yeah,
I'm going to. And so he said, you know, if you get more and more horses, you'll believe that you're doing it.
Yep. We get that same warning in Deuteronomy 7 and Deuteronomy 9,
right,
where it's like, do you think that you conquered this land by yourself?
Yeah, it's constantly saying, mm-hmm, remember what God's part
important.
Is, remember it's what
continuous
I do.
Continuous lesson throughout this book.
And then wives, well, you know, Solomon,
right,
David didn't do terribly well with this one either. And you see at the end of David's life, his multiple wives and his complete family chaos.
Yeah.
But then Solomon...
Especially in the transition of power from David to Solomon. Yeah, that was
And then
bad.
You get Solomon who goes, you know, if... Solomon, I can't remember how many wives he had, but it was one...
I think the number's 1,000. So 700 wives, 300 concubines.
Right. And it's... Yeah, I mean, and it's... And really, this is a political comment. It's not... so much so that Solomon could sleep with somebody different every night.
Yeah.
Wives were acquired in political moves. And so their wives were,
it's almost like signing a treaty or something.
Yeah. So he's constantly, God through Moses is saying, look, I want you to be ever so careful at the political moves that you make. And one of the main reasons is, he said, if you make political moves like you ally yourselves with this group of people and you bring you will not only bring the people, you will bring their religious practices in. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. Solomon started building temples for all his wives to worship their particular gods. And that was diametrically opposed to everything God had told the people that they should be.
Right, right. And what's interesting is the way that the author of Kings compares Solomon to Pharaoh, who is like Israel's greatest oppressor. And now Solomon is looking more and more like Pharaoh, who's
absolutely
getting horses from Egypt, who's making his own people slaves in order to
exactly
build himself giant houses, which he spent twice as much time building than he did to build the
and
temple.
There's this really interesting move where the oppressed... become the oppressor.
Yeah.
And actually, you see it in so many historical situations where the people are released from oppression and then they become the oppressor.
Mm. Well, I think that's a great point and well worth reflection. I think before we move on to our third question, as we're spending a lot of time on the first two, we should at least read 1 Timothy 2 for you guys, just so we kind of know what we're doing with that with that last question there. So 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2 says, first of all, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings, and for all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life. So not only do the rulers have a responsibility to rule justly, but their subjects have a responsibility to pray for their
right.
rulers. It's a both and.
And he also says two pretty interesting things, which I know that we're going to look at on Sunday. We've looked at on Sunday, and that is that the king should not consider himself to be above everybody else.
Yeah.
And secondly, his constant companion should be the Word of God.
Tim Mackey says that the only thing that kings are supposed to do is to be Bible nerds.
Yeah.
I think he says that because he himself is a Bible nerd. But All right, third question, prophets. Moses, this is our third question about prophets. Moses is a pretty big deal. The weight of responsibility God gave that man and the frequency of divine revelations he received is unparalleled in both the Old and New Testaments. But, like John the Baptist, Moses taught Israel to look beyond himself to a prophet like me, a prophet like Moses. This prophet, we now know, is Jesus. What does Moses' description of this prophet like me teach us about Jesus? List as many attributes, roles, responsibilities, experiences, Deuteronomy 18 and 32, teach us about this coming prophet that he should have.
Well, it's really interesting because he points towards Jesus, but he definitely establishes some guidelines for the prophets that we will see in the whole of in the way in which because when you see about the prophet who falsely claims to speak in my name, you know, you think about poor old Jeremiah who was calling upon the people to repent. And all of the other prophets were saying, no, you don't want to worry about it. No, you don't need to worry about anything.
Sure, sure. Peace when there is no peace.
Yeah, when there is no peace. It's really interesting. Obviously, ultimately, the prophet that's like me is Jesus.
Yeah.
But there's a line of prophets which takes us from Moses to Jesus.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, which a lot of these things apply to. And it's really interesting sometimes, you know, you sort of think to yourself, okay, so how literally can we take this? Because somebody comes and prophesies something, you say, well, I'm not going to treat you as a prophet until I find out whether what you're going to, if a prophet comes like Jeremiah did and said, repent, or you will be in deep trouble. It was Jeremiah only authenticated as a prophet when the people ended up in exile. They should have taken some notice of him beforehand. A number of people who've reading saying, you know, some of the things that warnings that we receive here perhaps are not supposed to be taken as literally
or as the only
way to approach things,
measure to tell whether this prophet's legitimate or not.
But clearly, if somebody prophesies something specific, and of course prophecy, I mean, it's also important to remember that today, if you look, that New Testament prophecy is different than Old Testament prophecy. You know, God makes it clear here that he said that the Old Testament prophets are because you wanted somebody to speak.
Right.
He says here, I'm going to send you prophets because you said you didn't want to speak to me directly. At Mount Horeb, you said, okay.
That's a fascinating account, right? Right. The people asked for intercessors
because they refused to fellowship directly with God.
Yeah.
He then sent them, and they took precious little notice of them.
Right, right. Another distinction between Old and New Testament, you just look at the first verse of Hebrews. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he spoke to us by his Son. So there's this transition in epochs and in eras. And if you were just to look at the last few verses of the book of Deuteronomy, we'll see that the author of at least this last little epilogue, who can't be Moses because Moses has passed away at this point, says, and there has not arisen a prophet like Moses in all of Israel. And then it says some of the characteristics of Moses, which described him and no other prophet since his time, whom the Lord knew face to face. So we can expect for this coming prophet like Moses to be someone whom the Lord knows face to face, and then also none like him for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to do in Egypt. So it also describes his mighty power and great deeds. So this coming prophet, among other things, will be one who performs great powers and signs, and also will know the Lord face to face in a way that these other prophets, though certainly believers, as we are today, will know God in a special way like Moses did. This is obviously true of the second member of the Trinity.
Right. And it's interesting, you see, because in verse 17, I will put my words in his mouth, and I will tell the people everything I command him. So Jesus said, I don't do anything without my Father, without my Father telling me. So, you know.
That's great. Our last question is about war. This one's really fascinating and difficult, but important. This chapter, chapter 20, divides into three sections. The first and third sections prescribe laws for warfare in all contexts. Well, the second section distinguishes between war against peoples far away and war against peoples close by. Was Israel to be an imperialistic society? Think now in terms of promised land versus land not promised. While the destruction that the Lord authorizes in this passage may alarm us, the purpose here is to curb sin and injustice. How do these laws curb sin and injustice?
It's really very interesting because you start off at the beginning of chapter 20 when he talks about when you go to fight your enemies and face horses and chariots and armies great, do not be afraid. And like we've been saying, it says, for the Lord your God is going with you. He will fight for you against your enemies and will give you the victory. So it's clearly stated, okay, so you're going to war, but actually I'm going to do the fighting for you. Mm. So, and then he talks about the compassionate release from, the compassionate release for of soldiers.
Yeah.
Number one, from building a new house. If you've built a new house and you may and it's not yet dedicated, if you've planted a vineyard, if you've been coming engaged to a woman not yet to be married and not yet married to them, and one of the things that I think that I've seen suggested, which it seems to make a lot of, is a sense that with these things, you know, God was leading him into a promised land. This promised land would flourish based on the agriculture of this land, the homes that the people built and the families they raised. And so he, in a sense, illustrates, he releases, he says, look, I'm going to do the fighting for you. So these people need to be given priority. And then it's interesting when he says, if you're scared, if you're scared, you can go home too. And then he says, always, you know, the question asks about imperialism. Always offer them peace. Always offer them peace. Verse 10, whereas you approach a town to attack it, you must first offer its people terms. you know, you could say, well, they offer them peace, but what you're actually offering them is surrender. Because he said, you know, they're going to become your servants.
Right. The assumption is that
they will serve you in forced labor. Yeah. But this is what's going to happen in the context of. But and then you get to the difference between the places that the land that God has given them.
Right.
In verse 17, you must completely destroy Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, and actually the Girgashites, which is missed in there.
Interesting.
But they have to be destroyed completely. But the people, because he's picturing two types of warfare. There's the conquering, which is taking the people into the promised land. Then there's the defensive. There's the defense on the borders of the promised land, which is in a sense these people that you're these people that aren't the Amorites, Hittites, and those people. Right. They're going to be eliminated. The other ones, you're going to eliminate the men, but you're going to keep everything else. Mm-hmm. And then there's this lovely bit about not cutting down trees.
Yeah, what a fun little detail.
Because I understand that a lot of the warfare for place people like the Egyptians, they would come in and they
slash
would...
Slash and burn, is that what it's called?
They would raise everything to the ground. Trees, yeah. Crops, houses, they would just eliminate everything. And God says, you know, in a sense, the trees are what makes the land what the land is. And, you know, there's no reason to...
And they certainly weren't as populous as they are in North America.
No.
So, of much more value. And, like, you talk here about the Oaks of Omri and things like that.
You can just use those trees to make siege for a purpose. You can't cut things down for no purpose.
All right, well, again, as always, there is more here than we could possibly talk about or preach about, so you have that challenge this week, or you have had that challenge, and we have the challenges, growth groups, to talk about it, the challenge and the pleasure. I hope you enjoy your conversation about this batch of laws and leadership and that you can apply it to your life and perhaps even the business where you work in or something like that. There are certainly...
As I wait, heart of God.